From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Lydon. This week, we look at one of the surprising issues at the root of the Syrian civil war.
4 years of drought turned almost 60% of Syria into deserts.
How a severe drought acted as a threat multiplier in Syria. And over in Buenos Aires, the International Olympic Committee gives wrestling a thumbs up for the future games, plus a pork problem in Texas.
It's a 300-pound hog. If it's a big boar or a mama with piglets, it's going to charge.
And we'll hear new music from the rising queen of futuristic R&B, Janelle Monáe. This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. The battle for public opinion over what to do about Syria continues. While President Obama pushes hard to make his case that a military strike against Syria is imperative, the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, is on his own PR offensive. Last week, he spoke with a French journalist. Tomorrow, PBS airs an interview he did with Charlie Rose. Assad denies ever using chemical weapons. But the Obama administration says it has evidence. And Secretary of State John Kerry has called this juncture a Munich moment. That's a reference to Europe's failure to stop Nazi Germany in the lead-up to World War II. While the comparison may be too strong for some, White House officials are using the sense of purpose to drum up support at home and abroad. NPR's Nathan Rott reports.
It can best be described as disturbing. A video pans through a frenzied room, a room carpeted with the shirtless bodies of men and small children. That's a man slapping at the back of an unconscious boy, trying to revive him. This was the first of 13 videos posted to the Senate Intelligence Committee's website, videos that show the alleged chemical weapons attack on August 21st, and the first such videos that carry the Intelligence Committee's official stamp of authenticity, with members of Congress expected to vote on military action against Syria as early as Wednesday. 3 weeks from when that attack allegedly occurred, the Obama administration is going into a full court press. Here's Secretary of State John Kerry.
Those videos make it clear to people that these are real human beings, real children, parents being affected in ways that are unacceptable to anybody, anywhere, by any standards.
Kerry was speaking in Paris, where he met with French officials and leaders of the Arab League Sunday, part of his international effort to gather support for what he says will be a limited and targeted U.S. attack on Syrian military targets. He said that the number of countries ready to take action are in the double digits, and that all of the Arab leaders he met with agreed that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had used chemical weapons, but what would come of it was still unclear. Appearing on one of his five talk show stops Sunday, White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough spoke of similar certainty and uncertainty at home.
Not a single member of Congress has rebutted the intelligence as I've consulted with them. And the question then becomes, what are the consequences for him for having done this? And what does the world read from how we react to it?
That's what everyone's waiting to hear. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
As the world waits to see if and when the U.S. will intervene in Syria, we want to take a step back and examine how the effects of climate change brought two different regions to rebellion and war. One of them is Mali, and the other one is Syria. That's our cover story tonight, climate change and conflict. The background of the Syrian conflict can seem obscure to outsiders, but long before a shot was fired, there'd been drought. Let's go to the city of Deraa in February of 2011. This is where the spark ignited that triggered the civil war. Farmers there are unemployed. The dispossessed came into the city, and a group of young people were writing Arab Spring protest slogans on a wall. They were arrested and beaten.
And when that news broke, then there was a massive demonstration in the street. And that was the first spark, one can call, of the Syrian uprising.
That's Naim Chanda, editor-in-chief of the Yale Global Online Magazine. He argues that there are many ways to look at civil war, ethnic factions, economic divides, religious differences. But increasingly, he says we should look at climate change as a factor. Syria faced a devastating drought between 2006 and 2010, affecting its most fertile lands.
And these 4 years of drought turned almost 60% of Syria into deserts. And that is a huge amount of land which could not support cattle breeding and herding. So 80% of cattle died by 2009. And the water shortage and the dryness of the land basically drove out of employment more than 50% of farmers. So these farmers were completely penniless. They had no way of earning a living. And so in search of job, they started migrating towards the cities they could go to.
I believe UN studies showed that somewhere between 2 and 3 million people were affected by this kind of dislocation, that 800,000 people lost almost everything, as you say. So you've got about 1.5 million farmers coming into the city. Tell us, how does the Syrian government react then?
Almost callously, because they turned to the international community. So UN agencies launched an appeal to EU. And also people felt that they are being discriminated against, they are not being helped, perhaps because of the sect they belong to, you know. I think this dislocation and the dire condition created the situation which started the first spark in Daraa.
Exacerbating things, the government began awarding the right to drill wells for water on a sectarian basis.
And then when the rains dried up, people started illegally digging wells because the permission to dig a well was a political act. And when people were desperate for water, they started haphazard digging well, and that damaged the aquifer even more.
Are you saying the drought caused the civil war? You're not saying that.
No.
You're saying that it's a hugely important enhancement factor.
Yeah, it is a multiplier of other causes which are existent in the society.
Right. What lessons do you think, Naim Chanda, we should take away from all of this? Could we see something similar in other places?
I can easily see that, because if you look at some of the unrest taking place in the developing countries, if you look at the deeper reason, a lot of ethnic animosity between a new group coming into an area looking for jobs or farming. Why did they come in the first place? Like in Daraa, they are coming because where they lived has become uninhabitable. So this migration, internal migration taking place, is going to happen more and more as this kind of climate catastrophe takes place. And if I may remind listeners that what happened in Syria, 1.5 million people uprooted, is the largest internal migration in the Middle East.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word internal, because what the outside world is seeing is that it is these internal conflicts that increasingly draw us in.
Yeah. And of course, then 2 million have now left Syria to go to Jordan and Turkey. But internal migration started building the pressure inside the country, which kind of exploded in Daraa.
Chanda is interested in making links between global events. More observers are including climate change into those connections. Let's turn to our second example, in Africa, and the region known as the Sahel, a grassy band running coast to coast along the southern edge of the Sahara. It's always faced periods of drought, but they're coming faster and faster. Robert Piper is the United Nations Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Sahel.
Instead of 10 years apart, they became 5 years apart, now only a couple of years apart. And that in turn is putting enormous stresses on what is already an incredibly fragile environment and a highly vulnerable population.
Add to this weak political institutions, ethnic and religious strife, and you have a recipe for conflict.
Tuareg rebels are fighting for independence and have been joined by Islamist groups apparently linked to Al-Qaeda.
These renegade troops have taken over
what they call their homeland of Azawad, with great speed.
Northern Mali is part of the Sahel. In January 2012, ethnic Tuareg rebels in northern Mali began an uprising against the government. Jihadist militants joined their campaign, eventually declaring the area an independent Islamic state. Ultimately, a coalition of West African and French military forces intervened. Control of northern Mali was restored, and a new government was elected. While Mali is tenuously quiet, the UN's Robert Piper says millions of people in the Sahel region are still at a risk of food insecurity.
This is an enormous territory. These are borders that are uncontrolled. So there's a tremendous amount of movement of people, a tremendous amount of movement of smuggling and trafficking. No question, we had attacks in Niger in April. So there's clear evidence that there's a problem that stretches across the region. It's not confined to northern Mali.
During the conflict, over 300,000 people in Mali fled their homes. They were fleeing war, but they were also fleeing drought. Nain Chanda would call such people climate refugees.
People don't call them that because often in people's mind, climate refugees are those who leave their homes inundated by the rising seawater. But I look at climate refugees, those who have lost their livelihood and housing for not only rising water, but for tornadoes, for wildfires. I would consider them to be climate refugees.
Climate refugees. It's a phrase we're going to be hearing more often, perhaps in places we've never heard of. But we will. Experts are increasingly aware that climate change, in addition to our human problems, can erode the social contract between citizen and government, between the people and the land. The ancient Olympic sport of wrestling will be the future Olympic sport of wrestling. Wrestling was the winner of a vote by members of the International Olympic Committee earlier today. It beat out squash and a combined bid by baseball and softball for inclusion in the 2020 and 2024 Games. NPR's Mike Pesca has been covering the IOC meetings in Buenos Aires, and he joins us now. Hello there, Mike.
Hello.
So a big win, Mike, for wrestling. What was it that convinced the voting members of the IOC to give the sport another try?
Well, the simple answer is passion and history and the massive levels of participation. But if you look at it a bit more subtly, the answer was actually contrition. Because you have to understand how wrestling even got to the point where it needed to be voted back in. And it was voted out by the executive board. And then wrestling had a choice. It could have said, how dare you? It could have said, what's the Olympics without wrestling? But they reorganized. They upended the leadership. They made a lot of changes. And every time and in every action, they expressed, we understand the message that you're giving us. We understand that we have to liven things up a little bit and reform a little bit. At one point during the question and answer session, a Lebanese delegate member of the IOC talked about how much he learned from wrestling, and the new president of FILA, the Wrestling Federation, turned that around and said, you have learned a lesson from wrestling. Now wrestling has learned a lesson from you. And to the delegates of the IOC, that's exactly the kind of tone they wanted to hear. And that's why wrestling got 48 of the 93 votes that were cast.
Wow. So do you think that these were just changes in who runs the Wrestling Federation Executive Board, or are they changes we're going to see as fans?
Well, there certainly were changes on the executive board, and that was, you know, a bit of a heavy lift to change the entrenched rulership. But yeah, no, we're going to see a fan tuning in to the next Olympics and going forward are going to see a little bit different look. The scoring is going to be a little bit easier to understand. And here's a news flash: maybe T-shirts and shorts, even changes as cosmetic as that, have been discussed.
You know, we talked about yesterday the sports of baseball and softball. What's going on with them?
Yeah, well, there's the baseball, softball, which was a combined bid, and also squash was one of the games that were considered. And those are fine games. They were good, strong bids. And perhaps in other years, the Olympics would have said, yes, we want those bids in the Olympics. But what happened because of the bizarre events with wrestling, it was really tough to go against a sport with 3,000 years of history. Also, if you just look at the levels of participation, you know, baseball claimed 35 million participants worldwide, squash 20, but wrestling says it has 70 million participants. I think it's a bit of a disservice to squash and baseball and or softball to just compare it to wrestling and say that it doesn't compare. Perhaps if the entire process were a little bit different, and this is what some IOC members were saying to me, perhaps if there were a way to send a message to wrestling to reform, but then to hold a vote, which would be open to other sports, that would have been a bit more fair to other sports. I mean, I looked at the squash bid. They talked about having the squash cube be portable and put in an excellent vista wherever you wanted to do it. Only 64 new athletes would be involved in squash. Maybe what the Olympics needs to do, and this isn't just my thought, this is what a lot of members are saying, is instead of just tossing out a whole sport, look at what are called disciplines. So you don't toss out swimming, but maybe let's look at synchronized swimming, to pick an example that most American fans say, why is this in the Olympics? And maybe that, if you need to cut, maybe the cut would come from a discipline like that in favor of a sport like squash. Just something to think about that they'll be considering as they elect a new president on Tuesday.
Well, thank you for a most definitive account. That's NPR's Mike Pesca in Buenos Aires with the latest news from the International Olympic Committee meetings there. Mike, thanks again.
You're welcome.
Now we turn to a different kind of sport.
They're about to die.
Okay. I got two. There's two, three.
Hunters in Texas shooting their game from a helicopter. But they're not aiming at bears or deer. They're hunting feral hogs. These wild animals repopulate at such a rapid rate, about 20% per year, that in 2011, Texas allowed them to be hunted all year round. It even spawned a reality show called Apocalypse Now, featuring who else? Ted Nugent, shooting hogs from the sky.
Wild hogs are now spreading out of control.
They are a growing menace.
Once just a rural problem, the apocalypse is closing in on Dallas. The city isn't shooting the animals from the sky. What they're doing is bringing in a professional trapper with years of experience.
Well, I've hunted all my life, ever since I was small. And my father always told me, if you do something you love, you never work a day in your life.
That's Osvaldo Rojas. His company, City Trapping, is trying to remove the hogs from the city within a few years because left alone, these hogs are about as fertile as rats.
One adult sow can have 6 to 10 piglets. Out in the woods, I guarantee you 99% of the piglets are going to make it. At 6 months, that same piglet is already fertile.
The population has grown to nearly 3 million in Texas. That's roughly half of all the feral hogs in the country. And because they do hog-like things like bathing in rivers that are spreading diseases, ruining the parks, turning the city into a pigsty.
I mean, if you think about it, Dallas spends millions of dollars on upkeeping at a park, and one hog can tear up half an acre in a night.
Hog damage is costing Texas $52 million annually, and there have been close feral encounters. People have reported attacks.
It's a 300-pound hog. If it's a big boar or a mama with piglets, it's going to charge.
Rojas says hogs have actually flipped him over about 5 times in the last month alone.
I've had quite a bit of injury, stitches, a couple of broken bones, about 8 pairs of boots. You name it, jeans. I just stopped buying jeans. I just wear them ripped now.
To cull the hogs, Rojas has set up feeding stations around the city. They're equipped with video cameras that he can control remotely with his cell phone. And once the entire pack is inside, he closes the gates.
We have some videos where they're running and they run into the gate to try to... They're not trying to get you. They're trying to get away.
You got them all.
And that's when they turn a little aggressive. So if there's a trailer there, they're going to run straight into the trailer.
And you know what? Rojas and his team will end up catching more hogs than even Ted Nugent. And best of all, when the day is done...
I mean, I eat it myself. I never buy meat.
And it's fun.
Yeah, I love chasing these little things. That's how I stay in shape.
Of all the world's birds, perhaps none are more mystical than cranes. That's the unison call of the red-crowned crane, a mated pair calling out to each other. From Asia to North America, these tall birds with their haunting cries have been woven into paintings, literature, folktales. But today, 10 of the world's 15 crane species are threatened, some on the brink of extinction. Their grass and wetland habitats are being devastated all the world over. The International Crane Foundation is working to change that. Based in Wisconsin, the ICF turns 40 this year. George Archibald founded it with another young ornithologist on a family farm near Baraboo. George Archibald is still caring for cranes around the world, and he joins us from a field expedition outside Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. Welcome to the program, George.
Thank you very much. Thrilled to be with you all.
Well, we're so glad you could be with us from such a long way away. George, tell us a little bit about the species. What are these birds like?
Cranes are man-sized birds. Most of them are 4 to 5 feet tall. They're monogamous. Nothing they do is without grace. The common denominator in cranes is that they are long-legged, long-necked birds with very big voices. Their voice can be heard for several miles on a still morning. The Wisconsin environmentalist philosopher Aldo Leopold, writing back in 1935, wrote so eloquently about cranes. And one of the sentences he wrote is, "The silence discernible in some wetlands perhaps arises from their once having harbored cranes. Now they stand humbled, adrift in history." When you see a marsh without cranes, it's very silent. When a crane is in a marsh and they call, there's this great spirit that lifts up in that area and brings life and meaning to the whole place.
What is the sound of the whooping crane?
Whoop! Really, that's what it sounds like. It's whoop, doop, doop, whoop, doop, doop, whoop, doop, doop. And the doop, doop is the female and the whoop is the male. That's their duet.
Ah, and they also do this incredible mating dance, right?
Yes, they throw sticks in the air. They jump high in the air. They run in circles and they'll run side by side. Then they'll actually jump into the air, go for a distance, land, and continue to circle and bow. And it must be quite exhausting.
I have visited the International Crane Foundation, and what you say about the stately, graceful way these creatures walk really resonates. They all have this incredible, beautiful waltz of a walk. George, at the International Crane Foundation, you have, I believe it's an African gray-crowned crane with big poof on its head named Slidell. I believe this bird is from Kenya, a place where you've had some success at their restoration?
Yes, they're from East Africa. We're very concerned about the beautiful cranes of Africa, particularly the crown cranes. They're being captured illegally and sent to the estates of the wealthy in the Middle East and to safari parks in China and to animal dealers in Europe. We've had an 80% decline of the birds in East Africa, but we have had some successes too. We have wonderful people working out there. Maurice Wangela has established a community group to protect the cranes and the wetlands. And another guy named Jimmy Mabwila in Uganda has actually restored some wetlands that were drained and the cranes have come back.
Tell me about the cranes that live in the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea.
The demilitarized zone between North and South Korea is about 4 kilometers wide and has several valleys where about one-third of the world's red-crowned cranes spend the winter and where about one-half of the world's white-naped cranes, that's about 3,000 birds, spend the months of October, November, and February, March. It's a wildlife paradise because it's a no-man's land. But unfortunately, there are plans afoot to develop the lowland areas into factory zones to provide jobs for North Koreans through South Korean-built factories. As long as tensions remain high between North and South Korea, the cranes are fine. But should things soften, the South Koreans have all these development plans on the table.
In a sense, is it possible to talk about the health of the planet, the biodiversity that remains through the lives of creatures like the cranes?
Oh, sure. Large vertebrates are very good indicators of the health of our environment. And cranes, particularly because they require wide expanses of wetlands and grasslands, And if the cranes disappear, we know that something is wrong in that environment.
Why do you think that cranes are so revered culturally? I'm thinking of the kimonos of Japan. You're on your way to Japan. I'm thinking of the 1,000 paper cranes, the symbol of peace at Hiroshima. What is it?
Well, they're simply beautiful creatures, and they live a long time. They live 20 to 30 years in the wild and in captivity. They can live into the ripe old age of 60 or so. They breed very slowly. They lavish care on their young, which is a value embraced by many people. And they're about our size in many cases, so we can identify with them. And when you have beautiful things in your environment, you want to paint them, you want to make stories about them, you want to dance like them. Cranes are one of the few birds that really know how to dance.
And finally, George, I understand your own love of birds goes back to childhood. Am I right?
Yes. My first memory in life is crawling on my hands and knees in Nova Scotia on a farm after a mother duck and her brood. And I claim to have been imprinted and following birds ever since.
George Archibald is the co-founder and senior conservationist at the International Crane Foundation. He spoke to us from a field trip in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. George, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you, Jackie. It's an honor to speak to you. And we invite everybody to visit us in Wisconsin.
In the U.S., it's easy to take the internet for granted. Not only has it changed the way we live and work, it's become our new public square. At this point, expressing an opinion online is second nature. But in China, it's a lot more complex. China has some 600 million internet users, and that's more than anywhere else in the world. But the so-called Great Firewall can censor certain opinions, even targeting specific words to be blocked. To hear more about how the Chinese government censors the internet and the underground code words that managed to beat it, we're joined in our studios now by Xiao Cheng. He's the editor of the China Digital Times, a bilingual Chinese news site based in California. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with a sense of what this massive internet usage is like in China. What if I want to go to, say, a forbidden site, not just having my books delivered by Amazon, but maybe books people don't want me reading? How much of the internet is available that way?
We often hear the name Great Firewall. If we want to be more precise, this term particularly referred to blocking websites from outside of China at the national gateway level. Inside of Chinese internet, there's whole different layers of the censorship by a top unit called Propaganda Department. Inside of China, that's where the most actually dynamic content is being generated, and sometimes even about political system and political reform itself. It has gone way beyond of just political activists. It's a common discussion. Despite all the control and monitoring of the government, there is a fundamental desire of the people who simply wants to express themselves. And if they cannot speak directly, they'll speak in alternative ways.
What are some of the words? Your group has looked at ways of people using words online to try to circumvent the censors. And you've done a lot of cataloging of this constantly evolving language that people use.
Right. This is a very fascinating phenomenon that since I've been following the Chinese internet politics since 2002. At the beginning, our research was purely focused on the censorship itself. We noticed how the government trying to control the online political discussion by preventing certain words, for example. You cannot say June 4th, which is a date of 1989 Tiananmen massacre. Anybody mentioned that name, computer program will identify that word and prevent that being published altogether, right? But people say alternative words. For example, in this case, people don't say June 4th. People say May 35th. Mm-hmm. So then once the May 35th becoming understood what it referred to, then it goes into people's daily category. Same as, let's say another word, Celestial Empire is a ancient word for China. But today, it's a common word, which often is a sarcastic use, refer the criticism of this state is not hardly modern. Yeah.
I'm just so curious. How does that sound in Mandarin?
Tian Chao.
So if I say Tian Chao and type that in, does the government now know I'm talking about the government?
Of course. Yeah. So that's not a secret code. It's a public code. These are the alternative terms in the Chinese political discussion online that already being what we call classic. People totally understand what is referred to.
Does anyone sit at home fearing that if they say Celestial Empire too many times, the cops are going to show up?
No, that's the beauty of those languages. It's become a fine line where people can still saying it, but actually not getting into a more direct trouble.
In the case of one of the most high-profile scandals in the last decade, the Bo Xilai case, so much discussion of the corruption took place online. Was that okay because the government had basically already decided he was guilty and were going to take him down?
That's part of it. The more important part is whether okay or not, government doesn't have a full control of the online political discussion. So we see all this harsh censorship from technology to law to the political crackdowns, but it doesn't reflect government has more control of the public speech. Rather, it refers to the government increasing anxiety of they lost that control.
Xiao Qian is the editor of the China Digital Times, and he teaches in the School of Information at UC Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Reading and learning have been enshrined in Baghdad's storied libraries for centuries. Some were destroyed by Mongol invaders hundreds of years ago, but more recently, the war in Iraq savaged the country's libraries. Looting and burning left many of them emptied of books and patrons. Now, for the first time in three decades, plans are afoot to restore Baghdad's former literary glory with a shining new library. The designs and renderings show a grand, marvelously constructed, state-of-the-art green building set atop a lake. Amir Moussaoui is director of AMBS Architects, the architectural firm responsible for the design of the new Baghdad Library, and he joins us from his office in London. Welcome, Amir Moussaoui.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Moussaoui, Iraq hasn't built a library in more than 30 years. What makes the time right now to do this, to create a new library?
Well, I mean, it's a young government, and they've sort of had a number of years to sort of resolve other issues. But one of the most important issues that needs to be tackled is restoring a level of education, and fundamental to that are public buildings that facilitate that, such as libraries.
I was a correspondent in Iraq in 2003, and will never forget the state the library at the College of Arts and Sciences was in at the Baghdad University, plundered, books strewn everywhere, wires ripped out, half-burned walls, just really, really sad. And now comes your new design. When you look at a picture of this building, it's a flying V or a teardrop. How do you describe it? Tell me about it.
Well, it is kind of like a teardrop shape. It takes form and plan. You know, the roof sort of articulates the word reed in Arabic, which was the first word that God spoke to the prophet. He said reed.
Mr. Moussaoui, you are born in England. You're of Iraqi descent. What does it mean for you to be able to bring this kind of edifice back to the city and the country?
You know, the knowledge infrastructure of the country has been destroyed, and everybody that, you know, was highly educated, a majority of them left, and they're all beginning to return, but it will take many years before people are confident enough to actually move their families back. So for me, it's very important because it's, you know, we see this as the rebirth of a new age of Iraq where they can hopefully concentrate on the positives. And, you know, the only real way to get ourselves out of this mess that we're in is through education.
That's Amir Moussaoui. He's director of AMBS Architects in London, the firm responsible for the design of the new Baghdad Public Library. And he joined us from his office in London. Mr. Moussaoui, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It was only this past Monday, you may recall, that the long-distance swimmer, Diana Nyad, became the first person to swim from Cuba to Key West without a shark cage. It was a stunning success for the 64-year-old swimmer, and it was made all the sweeter because she had tried and failed four times before.
We should never, ever give up.
Inspirational, but she also learned some practical lessons from the earlier attempts. This time, she used a full bodysuit and a mask to protect from jellyfish stings. Out of failure, she innovated, and out of innovation, she succeeded.
In my interviews with explorers, so many of them said, really, the only failure that counts is dying.
That's National Geographic staff writer Hannah Block. She looked into the value of failure in the September issue of the magazine. And since this is National Geographic, she focused on adventurers and explorers, like the Swede, Solomon August André. André was a humble patent clerk at the end of the 19th century. He was also a tinkerer, a risk taker, someone unafraid to try.
This was an era when the Arctic and the North Pole were really uncharted territory, and many people had tried to reach the North Pole by going overland, and they had died trying.
André saw these failures, and he thought he might have just the answer.
Solomon André just had this very bold, optimistic idea that he could basically circumvent a lot of the difficulties that others had encountered by going overland by going in a hydrogen balloon.
He convinced the King of Sweden and Alfred Nobel to back him. And on the 11th of July, 1897, he and a small crew took flight.
They had flown for 65 and a half hours, and they landed on the ice about 298 miles south of the North Pole.
It turned out to be a fatal error. Their remains were discovered some three decades later, along with a tuxedo, which André had brought along to wear on his triumphant return. But his failure was an inspiration to many other polar aeronauts. For example, the Italian explorer Umberto Nobile, who made the trip in 1926. He didn't use a hydrogen balloon, however. Now let's turn to another explorer and go somewhere a little bit warmer. Do you hear that? Listen closer. It's a jungle on the island of Borneo, and the faint rustling in the background is a maroon leaf monkey jumping from branch to branch high up in the canopy. Many years ago, American primatologist Agustin Fuentes was trying to study the animals in Borneo, but they're shy monkeys, and Fuentes had to keep trekking deeper and deeper into the lush environment to get a closer peek.
I got lost in the jungle and was actually helped by an orangutan who came down, got me, and walked me back into camp. Early in my career, I wanted to study those things on the edge, the last remaining members of a species. It was really a lesson. I failed. So my experience there gave me the hint that, you know what? Maybe what you should be looking at is not these last few things living out there, but those primates that do okay with people.
Since then, Fuentes has made a successful career as a macaque researcher, a primate that is anything but shy.
Think about what the world would look like if there was no such thing as failure. What would be the point in doing anything? I think failure is what gives success its meaning.
Diana Nyad would agree with that, and so would Umberto Nobile, the guy who did fly to the North Pole in a dirigible. And it's time now for music. Janelle Monáe's music has been called funkadelic soul. It's been called futuristic R&B. But whatever you call it, it's almost impossible not to dance to it.
Ooh, you shock it, shake it, baby. Shock it, baby. Electric lady, you're a star.
The 27-year-old artist has already been nominated for 6 Grammy Awards since her debut album in 2010. And her new album out this week is called The Electric Lady.
Electric.
Janelle Monáe visited us at her studios here in Washington, D.C. Janelle Monáe, welcome to the program. Such a pleasure.
Oh, I'm just honored that you guys are taking the time to speak with me.
You know, we have been just loving this album. Who are the electric ladies in your life, Janelle?
There are many. One, I will say that electric ladies are not to be marginalized. And I think that you are an electric lady. I think that electric ladies are community oriented. They're women, you know, of many different shapes and colors and sizes. And when she walks in the room, you know an electric lady.
Let's listen to one of the tracks here. It's called Queen, and it features the queen herself, your co-queen, I would say, Erykah Badu.
I can't believe all of the things they say about me. Walk in the room, they go in shade, left to right. They be like, ooh, she's serving face. And I just tell them, cut me up and get down.
Erykah was one of the first female artist to reach out to me when I had just released my EP, and you know, not a lot of people knew about Janelle Monáe, and she discovered me online and she said, I want you to come out on tour with me. So we talk on the phone daily, and Queen, our song together, was really inspired by private conversations that she and I continue to have about our community and how we can uplift them and how we can deal with those who feel marginalized and who don't often have people standing up for their rights, you know, whether it be the gays, the lesbians, the immigrants. And women are oftentimes marginalized, and we wanted to show that two strong women can work together and create something great.
About the neighborhood where you grew up.
I grew up, I was born and raised in the Midwest, Kansas City, Kansas, and I grew up in one of the poorest counties, Wyandotte County, and I grew up to hardworking parents. Both of my parents worked day and night for the community. They were janitors at one point in time. They were trash, you know, men, and they also worked in the post office. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, wore uniforms every single day and helped our community move forward. And they just taught me the importance of working hard and turning nothing into something. I would say, because I'm older and I understand class and different things, you know, I didn't grow up in a middle or a upper class. We grew up poor, but I never knew that because I was always surrounded around love. And family is just so important. One of the biggest sacrifices that I've made to date has been leaving my family.
You had some really great female role models in your mother and your grandmother.
Yeah. I will say that one of the biggest advantages I think I've had as a young woman and a young artist has been growing up the way that I have. I was a maid at one point in time because I was going to New York. I wanted to study arts in New York, and I didn't have any money. I actually went up to my pastor and I said, I need the church to pray that I find this job because I want to go to New York, but I don't have any money. And there was a lady who walked up to me afterwards and she said, I'm the supervisor at the maids and I'll hire you. You just come.
Wow.
And so I went every day and I got a chance to be around women who were, you know, poor, trying to make it. And I was the youngest there and they knew I could sing. So they would ask me to sing when we would clean these houses and I would drive this car. And that was my life for like 3 months. And it taught me so much. It inspired me to want to write music to inspire these people because they need it the most.
Your music's been called R&B. It's been called psychedelic soul. It's been called funk. Let's listen to one of the singles off this album. This one's called, I love it, Dance Apocalyptic.
Yes.
Dance apocalyptic, bands that make her dance apocalyptic now. Bands that make her dance apocalyptic. Bands that make her dance apocalyptic now. Bands that make her dance.
It's so danceable. It's just great.
Yeah, Dance Apocalyptic was inspired by an innovator, someone who inspired rock and roll, someone who inspired the Beatles, someone who inspired the Rolling Stones. We're talking about Bo Diddley.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
He's an originator.
And mm-hmm.
I wanted to, with this particular album, I wanted to go through R&B music that ranges from people like Bo Diddley to Jimi Hendrix to classical music. And so that's what I love doing, is playing with all these different styles of music and creating something that just has not been heard.
What's the matter? Your chicken tastes like pork?
You have triplets instead of twins? Does your food taste plastic?
Last year, you signed on as a rep for the beauty products company CoverGirl.
Yes.
You certainly got the classic looks. Just tell me a little bit about that. What was going on there?
I was very surprised, I must say, because I grew up like all girls, looking at magazines and trying to figure this thing out. You know, if I'm going to be myself or do I want to try to fit in and, you know, what makes me beautiful and...
Is my
All
face a
questions.
Perfect circle, or is it a pyramid, or am
exactly.
I a pear?
Should I wear mascara, or should I, you know, all these little things that we do as women, and just as people, we're curious about what we should do next with ourselves. And so when they reached out to me, we talked about my core values, and one of them has always been to encourage and inspire young girls to embrace and love the things that make them unique, even if it makes others uncomfortable.
Now, you've visited the White House more than once, and earlier this spring you actually performed for the President and First Lady. What was that like?
I got a letter in the mail when they hosted South Korea maybe a couple years ago, and Michelle and Barack, our First Lady and President, invited me to perform at the state dinner. And that was my first time at the White House, and I was so... I just couldn't believe it. I was like, who played this trick on me? I thought they were so busy they didn't even know who I was. And turns out that Michelle is a huge fan, and she, you know, invited me to perform the state dinner. Then I got asked to come back for her annual Easter egg roll. Then I got asked to come back again for a Christmas party. And then we closed out the inauguration for a private party. And so I love them so much.
So did anybody dance at the White House?
What? Oh, my gosh.
Did
kidding?
They get
we
dance?
We had a ball. Let's just say one of the nights ended with me on top of Valerie Jarrett's table, kicking over glasses.
What a star. It has been such a pleasure. Janelle Monáe's new album is called Electric Lady, and does she sell it? Janelle, thank you for visiting us
thank
today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored.
Ending September 8th, 2013. That's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Matt Martinez, Shula Newman, Deborah George, Jessica Reedy, Elliot Hannon, Sarah Ventry, Chris Connolly, Andrew Fishman, Rachel Rood, and Petra Mayer. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mithoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Hey, thank you for listening.